Our guest this week is Bob Nayman of Just Foreign Policy. He's a longtime peace activist and advocate. His focus in recent years has been on US foreign policy, specifically around the war in Yemen, as well as other conflicts overseas. And a lot of his work and the work of Just Foreign Policy has been not just to end wars, but also to ameliorate, as an interim step, the impact that they have on civilians and others. And so I think it's helpful to have Bob's experience and Bob's perspective as we look at the situation that's still unfolding in Ukraine, where, of course, there's an active war as we speak. We're speaking here the third week of March. The tactics being used by the Russians seem to be getting more intense. There have been claims of possible use of white phosphorus. There have been claims and counterclaims on both sides of the conflict. There have been allegations or suggestions, insinuations around the use of chemical weapons and other tactics or tools that would be a breach of various international law requirements. So we're still in a volatile period, and so helpful, I think, to both look at what's happening right now as well as what the coming weeks and months might hold. As I say, we're talking on the third week of March or early into the fourth, and at this stage, reports are that there are up to 10 million refugees who have fled Ukraine. Reports yesterday or today were that up to half of Ukrainian children have fled their homes. Some of those will still be displaced internally inside of Ukraine, of course. Others are among that large figure of 10 million refugees mentioned earlier. Ukraine has introduced martial law, and so most men aged between 18 and 60 are required to stay inside the country. And so most of the figure we're seeing, as is, of course, common for many international conflicts, are many of the displaced we are seeing relate specifically or primarily to women and children. A large part of the focus, as I've observed it here in Ireland, of the war has focused around information warfare. Obviously, there's a very real and violent war on the ground in Ukraine, but we have seen the importance of misinformation, of propaganda, of persuasion, all the tools of information warfare being used. And there have been, in the last week or two, we've seen increasing attacks on civilians. There have been allegations, as I mentioned, of the use of white phosphorus, allegations of targeted attacks on various civilian infrastructure. We've seen, of course, the images coming out of attacks on maternity hospitals, children's hospitals, and the like. As a result of this, there have been perhaps an unprecedented level, or at least in recent decades, unprecedented for recent decades, of multilateral and multinational intervention and responses, particularly from countries in the West. We've seen significant levels of military aid from, particularly from other former Warsaw Pact countries, but also from across Europe, tellingly from Germany, which of course has revised much of its military stance over the last number of decades, and from the US. There have been sanctions placed on Russia, significant sanctions, the freezing not only of trade, of placing individuals close to the government, but also significant industrial and economic figures within Russia under personal sanctions. Also the freezing of the reserves of the Russian central bank held abroad. So we're seeing unprecedented levels of sanctions as part of attempts to place significant pressure on Russia. At the same time, it's been notable that while President Zelensky and others have been calling for a no-fly zone, for looking for support from NATO members, particularly the US, in relation to calling for and imposing a no-fly zone, that is something that the US and other countries have resisted. The argument there being largely that would have the effect of requiring foreign aircraft to essentially be willing to shoot down Russian aircraft in Ukrainian airspace, which would be an overt act of war and risk intensifying and expanding this conflict further. So we're at a time where there's been significant harm to tens of millions of civilians. There's been an invasion of a neighboring country, something we haven't seen in Europe in the last decade or two, in the last two decades or so. And there has been what's being described as the largest influx of refugees into Europe since World War II. So a very troubling picture, a very risky picture. There are thousands dead already. We don't know the exact figures, and not clearly a sense to my mind as to any what we might see as an exit path or any easy way out of our current situation. Bob, is there anything significant I've missed there? Are there, you know, what is your thoughts on the overall situation we face at the moment, and what should be the major issues we should be keeping an eye on and concerned about at this time?
The overall situation is horrible, and I think there's something to be said for acknowledging from the get-go that we're at a 9/11 type juncture in two ways. One is just, I don't know how it is in Ireland, but I bet it's similar. If you are a media consumer, you are now immersed in a daily horror show. You know, every time I pick up my phone, there's three more horror show headlines about Ukraine. And that's traumatic. You know, as a human being, that's traumatic to witness what's happening now, regardless of what brought us to the Russian invasion, to experience daily, be subjected to daily. I'm not saying that we should feel sorry for ourselves, I'm just saying as human beings, we should acknowledge that we're watching these images and being hit with these headlines, and every day it seems like it's something worse. And that's traumatic. And that's like, you know, after 9/11, when they kept showing the same clips over and over on cable news and the plane hitting the second tower and the building coming down and everybody running away. So we should acknowledge that we're experiencing that. The second way it's like 9/11 is that it's a scene change. As you mentioned in your introduction, things have happened that nobody expected to happen. Assumptions are being knocked down. The pivot of Germany to a much more aggressive posture towards Russia, canceling of Nord Stream 2, increasing military spending, sending weapons to Ukraine, things that were no-go for the German government for years, up until this juncture. So we have to, you know, re-examine our assumptions about how the world works, because now we're in this, at least for many, if not most of us, in this unexpected juncture. The way this ends is diplomacy. I mean, what are the choices? Either Russia military defeats Ukraine, or Ukraine militarily defeats Russia, or else there's a diplomatic settlement. And the question is, how do we get there? It's easy to say there's no military solution. That's said all the time. You know, for 15 years in Afghanistan, we said there's no military solution. They kept the war going. And you could give lots of other examples from around the world where, you know, all the smart people said there's no military solution, and the war kept going because, you know, the two sides were not ready to agree on something that the other side could agree to. And that's unfortunately where we are now. Apparently, all the signs are more escalation before there's any diplomatic agreement. And that's very unfortunate, obviously tragic and horrible. I think looking at it from the point of view of a peace activist in the United States, it's hard to see how in the short run, it's hard for me to see in the short run, how peace activists in the United States have any plausible path to getting the US government to do something different from what it's doing. It feels like the cake is baked. The constraints on Biden are, you know, not starting a nuclear war with Russia and whatever the Europeans will agree to. If you look at the votes in Congress, support for what Biden is doing in Ukraine now is overwhelming, bipartisan, wall to wall. It's a tiny handful of objections. Most of the criticism is Biden do more. And Biden says, you know, we're doing everything we can, subject to the two constraints of not starting a nuclear war with Russia and keeping the Europeans on side. And as you know, Biden's going to Europe right now to push Europeans to do more. So in the short run, I fear that the bad news from a US peace movement perspective is that there isn't much we can do to change this trajectory. And what we should be thinking about more is, to the extent that we're talking about this, as opposed to talking about something else like Yemen or Afghanistan, because this is the thing that's dominating the news, even though it's not, you know, I would argue that if you look in terms of the power dynamics in the United States, we have a much, like we have 1,000 times better prospects from a, you know, political strategic point of view of doing something about what's happening to civilians in Yemen than we do about doing what's happening to civilians in Ukraine, because that cake is baked. The support for what Biden is doing is overwhelming. We don't control Putin. We don't control Zelensky. And we have, you know, not much margin on Biden because of the political dynamic. Whereas it's plausible that in the next month, we could win a vote in Congress to end unconstitutional US participation in the Saudi genocide in Yemen, which at least up until, you know, the last time I looked, situation had changed, which is the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, and the one where the United States government has the most say. But to the extent that we find ourselves compelled to talk about Ukraine, because that's the thing that's dominating the media, that's what people are talking about, I think the main thing we should be thinking about is, you know, what can we say, even if we can't do anything about this now, what is it that we should be trying to say about this that improves our position in the future? Improves our position for peace in the future. And so just as we have to be aware of, you know, as Hillary Clinton might say, never let a crisis go to waste. That's what people who want more war in the future are doing. They're not letting a crisis go to waste. They're increasing the US military budget. They're trying to use the juncture to do a reset between the US and Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis and the UAE will pump more oil to reduce, to counteract the oil price shock of the war and the cutoff of Russian oil, but mainly the war. There's all kinds of collateral effects happening, right? Like the, you know, the impact on famine, bad enough already, but now you have the what's happening to wheat prices, given that Russia and Ukraine are major wheat exporters,
and particularly major exporters to North Africa, the Mediterranean basin, and so on. And so, I know reports out of Tunisia, out of Egypt, and the like, pointing directly to that fact that I think is it 30% of the world's wheat coming from Ukraine and Russia, and the likely impact that's going to have on basic food staples, on the likelihood of food poverty in places like that, which we saw previously, apart from the immediate impact that has on on poverty, on hunger, was one of the factors we saw in the run-up to the Arab Spring in 2010, 2012, that it was spikes in basic food staples that were seen as a root cause, or an immediate cause of both activism, but also instability in those countries.
Yes, and this is happening in a situation of fragility, mm-hmm. right? This is happening when many of these countries, as the whole world, but of course the poor suffer the most, hit very hard by COVID, by restrictions, by the impact on health systems. And it was already the case that the UN World Food Program was underfunded. They just had a conference for funding for Yemen. They got a third of the pledges that they hoped for. Yemen's not the only case. So you have a number of countries where the situation was already fragile before this. And then on top of the impact, the direct impact of the spike in wheat prices, you have the focus impact, right? So the UN has their aid conference, Angelina Jolie goes to Yemen, says, care about Yemen too, but there's no oxygen in the room for talking about, or feels like there's little oxygen in the room for talking about what's happening in Yemen, what's happening in Africa, because the world's eyes are on Ukraine, because the media's eyes are on Ukraine. So it's a horrible, horrible juncture. Mm-hmm. And the sooner we can end this war, the better, obviously. And tragically, we don't seem to have much say over it. So in the meantime, we have to do all the amelioration that we can do. The UN called for a Ramadan ceasefire in Yemen. That would be a plus. It's never a bad time for a ceasefire. And they're working on, a ceasefire in Ukraine, which is also very hard. But one of the things that I hope will, on the positive side, we also, just as our adversaries, look at the new juncture and see how they can advance their long-term adversary agenda. So we should look at the juncture and see how we can advance our peace and human rights agenda. And we're seeing, just as we're seeing, Germany suddenly willing to do military things that they weren't willing to do before. So there are discussions about international law that weren't happening before. So, for example, the government of Ukraine has led a push to amend international law to make the crime of aggression prosecutable in the ICC and in the International Criminal Court. And I wouldn't have imagined a month ago that was even something, that would even be a topic of conversation. You know, the under the United Nations Charter, the crime of aggression, invading another UN member state without Security Council authorization, that's the highest crime. That's like the that's Article 1 of the UN Charter. That's the reason that the sensible reason that the United Nations was created after World War II to supervise the system of international law where countries wouldn't invade other countries. Exactly what's happening right now. And of course, we all know that the United States government and its friends have been tremendous hypocrites in this regard, invading Iraq in violation of the UN Charter, the war in Yugoslavia, and so on. But there is this new juncture where these conversations are happening. You know, the U.S. has, since at least the Iraq War, taken the approach that, you know, we don't really need the UN Charter. In practice, we don't really need the UN Charter. Suddenly, the United States, in this situation where the U.S. is clearly constrained, right? We're all having a naked conversation about the limits of American power and European power. And so the U.S. is turning to international law and diplomatic tools that it previously gave the back end of the hand to. And we can hope and push that this juncture could turn into a period where the US and Europe, obviously the US is the senior partner in this relationship, will be less cynical about these structures, will be less cynical about international law, will take more care follow the rules that they're now, follow the laws that they're now calling Russia to account for. And that's something that, you know, looking at the United States, if I compare like the US to Western Europe, you look about the conversation around the Iraq War, let's take England, let's take Great Britain. Great Britain was a full participant in the crime, right? But if you compare the discussion in the United States to the discussion that happened in Britain at the time and afterwards, the discussion in Britain, even among conservatives, there's much greater belief in international law that the United Kingdom has to obey international law, has to pretend to obey international law, has to pretend to respect the United Nations. In the US, that discussion didn't even exist. So if we could just move the United States to a place that's like the United Kingdom at the time of the Iraq War, where at least that's a framework that people are accountable to when we're talking about the main discussion of US policy, that we're accountable to that, that would be an advance. And we can hope, again, when the Bush administration invaded Iraq, they ultimately took a my way or a highway approach and didn't even care about France, you know? So I'm hopeful that if we're now entering a period where the US is closely cooperating with all the countries of Western Europe, that could act as a constraint on the collection. They're banding together in order to try and be more powerful in the confrontation with Russia. But if there's a real dialogue and agreement that says, okay, now we're all going to cooperate to obey the rules that we're trying to enforce, that would be a big advance in human history.
I want to bring you back to something you mentioned earlier. You referenced the fact that the US is being drawn in part as a result, or largely, I suppose, as a result of the war in Ukraine and the subsequent sanctions on Russia, the desire to block Russia off from international markets. Russia, you know, we mentioned earlier, is a significant supplier of grain, as is Ukraine, but it's also, of course, a major international energy supplier. You know, much of the energy coming into Western Europe, into Europe, comes often as gas, also as oil, out of Russia. One of the things you mentioned was the U.S. seeking to encourage countries that have they've been less friendly to recently, Venezuela. But also Saudi Arabia, where there's been it's been noted that since Biden so in contrast to Venezuela, where there's a kind of a longer standing conflict, I suppose, of ideology, in the case of Saudi Arabia, particularly since Biden took office, he has sought to distance himself from direct contact with MBS, the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and has, I suppose, that's in part perhaps a consequence of the well-documented instances of human rights abuses associated with MBS in particular, but also Saudi Arabia, now seeking to replace Russian oil supplies. There have been the U.S. government has been reaching out to Saudi Arabia, to Venezuela, and asking them, seeking to have them increase their oil production in order to make up for the loss of Russian oil, in order also presumably to reduce Russia's leverage on the international stage. We've seen this morning word from, or maybe yesterday, word from Russia that they are going to require payment in Russian rubles from what they are terming unfriendly states, which would of course include Europe, and would have the effect of essentially requiring Europe, as long as it is dependent on Russian oil and gas, to prop up the Russian currency more than would be the case if it were in, as is often usually the case now, in US dollars. All of these different international conflicts into what we might see as different arenas are being pulled together, largely often, you know, by resource and by energy issues. In the case of the US reaching out towards Saudi Arabia and its actions around the Gulf, I think you may have mentioned that has an impact on the situation in Yemen, or on the geopolitical context within which the war in Yemen is continuing.
Yes, I mean, this has been openly reported in the U.S. press that the in the context, even before the Russian invasion as of Ukraine, as the U.S. was anticipating the Russian invasion of Ukraine and talked with Europe about the sanctions that they were threatening to impose if Putin invaded Ukraine, the U.S. Started reaching out to the Saudi government and the UAE government, and according to reporting in the Wall Street Journal, got the cold shoulder. And the MBS, the Saudi crown prince and reportedly de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia, said, basically, we're not interested in talking to you until you help us more with the war in Yemen, said this explicitly. So it's quite raw. And so it's raw and naked, you know, from a disinterested moral point of view, it's hard to make a case that Putin is intrinsically more evil a human being than MBS is. You know, the invade other countries, check, assassinate dissidents, check, you know. So the idea that we need to make nice with the Saudi regime and help them with their genocidal war in Yemen in order to confront Putin, the moral case is murky, to put it mildly. But the positive thing about the juncture is that this is so naked, that this is openly discussed in the press. I mean, I'm old enough to remember a time when there were two discussions of US foreign policy, like the mainstream media discussion, and then like the foreign affairs, you know, the mainstream media discussion is about democracy and human rights and blah, 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 and our values. And then, you know, there's foreign affairs, foreign policy that's about oil and pipelines and shipping lanes. And so now the two discussions are increasingly merged, and that's very healthy to have an honest discussion. Now, just before we started talking, I was reading an op-ed from a Ukrainian official talking about Biden's trip to Europe and how, you know, Biden's going to go to the Europeans and talking about how Europe is funding Putin's war machine with their continuing to import Russian energy. This is, you know, this is a flashpoint. And, you know, from his point of view, it's time for Europe to step up and do the right thing. Okay, well, the same, morally, the same argument applies to what Biden is now doing, his overtures to Saudi and UAE. And it's been an unquestioned assumption of US foreign policy since 1945 that the US and Saudi Arabia have this special oil relationship. And it's the job of the Saudis to help manage the oil price for the benefit of the American president. And it's the job of the American president to keep the Saudis happy so they'll help manage the oil price for the benefit of the American president. And this shibboleth, this assumption is now being openly discussed at this juncture where people are increasingly saying, as they should, this is insane. It's insane to say it's the job of the president of the United States and Western European leaders to confront the climate crisis. And it's also the job of the president of the United States to keep the price of gas low. These are two opposite ideas, and they can't both happen. So that's positive. It, you know, it's horrible. It's monstrous. It's mind-blowing that we're at this juncture, but it's positive that we're having an open discussion about it in the media, and everybody can see that this is what the US government is trying to do. And it is controversial in a way that it's never been controversial before. And Biden's gotten pushback from Congress saying, you know, what are you doing running cap in hand to Saudi and UAE? So this story isn't finished yet. You know, in the next month, in the next weeks, we could see a different ending than the story has had in the past.
And I'd mentioned the interplay between the different geopolitical arenas, the Gulf, Ukraine, and elsewhere. But of course, one of the things you noted there was climate. That, you know, one of the dominant public affairs issues of our time, one of the huge civilization threatening issues of our time is climate, and is the potential for climate change and destabilization there. And of course, one of the potentially positive things we've seen in the last week or two has been a focus on on shifting to renewable local energy as a way to to reduce dependence on Russian or external oil. So framed in the immediate as being about sovereignty and independence and autonomy, but also noted alongside that of course this would have the benefit of helping us meet existing commitments around climate change, around reducing our reliance on fossil fuels and on our creation of carbon and so on. Of course, the challenge there, we just had an announcement here in Ireland of plans for significant offshore wind farms, which have been the government has, I think, approved a new regulatory framework, or the outline of a regulatory framework, which will facilitate their construction and their operation. But we're looking at the earliest at 2027 for them to have to be meeting 20% of our current fossil fuel input. We're looking at another 20 years from now before we would be able to transition from fossil fuel under the sort of timetables that were announced there. So we're seeing both an interplay of issues, climate, energy reliance, geopolitics, all coming together, but also not just that these are difficult issues, but even where there are potential solutions, they're time consuming. These are not a set of issues that are going to be quickly resolved, even with concerted political will and with a pathway visible forward, I think.
Well, it's certainly true that some things take time. It's also true that if this is an emergency, which it is, the climate emergency is an emergency, and this conflation that we're seeing now, not only does the Russian oil and Saudi oil destroy the planet, but also, no, we're seeing this sovereignty thing. This isn't an abstraction now, right? We're seeing that the leverage of Saudi Arabia and UAE is being used to sustain the genocidal Yemen war, just as Putin has tried and is to some degree still using energy as a leverage for his war in Ukraine. So it's a double emergency. It's an emergency of destroying the planet, and the sovereignty that we're losing is the sovereignty to choose not to participate and enable horrible war crimes. So if it's that kind of emergency, maybe we should re-examine. You know, we can't do everything right away, but we could do some things right away. We saw during COVID that actually governments have a lot of power, even democratic governments. You know, they could shut everything down and send everybody checks. And you remember the pictures of the earth. We're like, wow, where did all the smog go, right? So it's time to re-examine assumptions about what we could do also in the short term, remembering that there are powerful interests saying, no, you can't, that, you know, the oil companies and the energy interests that are tied with these regimes, that are tied with the status quo. And so, although it's objectively true, we can't do everything right away, it's also true that there are powerful interests that are always saying, no, you can't. And we need to push the envelope and be more aggressive and think about things like We don't need to have a 5-day work week. Or maybe everybody doesn't have to work 9 to 5. Maybe we can spread it out. There's a lot of things that you could do. If this were the top priority, just like when COVID happened, that was the top priority. You know, when there's a real war, the war is the top priority. So if this were the top priority, you could do things like Defense Production Act things, government things, to say, okay, this is the top priority now. We're going to take some pain in the short run to make this decisive transition, and we're going to compensate the people who will suffer from the transition the most, just like we did in COVID, sending everybody checks to stay home. So we could do that now if we wanted, if we made this the top priority.
I wanted to turn to an issue that's been in my mind over the last day or so, in particular. One of the I mentioned early on that apart from military aid to Ukraine, there have been significant sanctions imposed, including some that went beyond what I think was anticipated by the Russians and by others. The freezing of the central bank reserves overseas, the shutting down of many sectors of imports and exports, including, we saw just yesterday, Renault, the French car company, which had continued to sell into Russia and operate plants in Russia, because that was not required, you know, it was not required under the sanctions for them to stop that, have now announced that under public pressure, including being called out by Zelensky in an address to French legislators, that they are going to shut down trade with Russia and their operations inside the country. In the case of Renault, that's 10% of their global sales are currently into Russia. They also own a share in the company that makes Lada, the Russian brand. It's unclear what's going to happen there. But so we've seen sanctions, and we've seen a corporate action to shut down operations from fast food to cars to social media, beyond even the legal sanctions required. And of course, sanctions are seen and are in many respects intended to be, should we say, a less lethal solution. They you know, rather than engage in war, in killing people, you engage in economic activity that is intended to put pressure without actual warfare. But I was reminded of a clip that following the death of Madeleine Albright, the former U.S. Secretary of State. Several people have been replaying her interview, or Leslie Stahl's interview with her, in which she was asked about the impact of sanctions on Iraq through the 1990s. This is after the first Gulf War in 1990. The U.S. Imposed significant sanctions on Iraq, and by the late 90s, Leslie Stahl was asking, was saying to Madeleine Albright, you know, the estimate was that perhaps 500,000 Iraqi children had died as a result of those sanctions, and asking, you know, the question she asked was that price worth it? And Madeleine Albright's response famously was that we believe it was. And it came to mind because, again, with the significant sanctions on Russia, some of those are aimed particularly at the rich, at what are termed in the, you know, what the West are terming in relation to Russia, the oligarchs, the, you know, the yachts, the mansions, the bank accounts, but a lot of the trade-based sanctions will undoubtedly have an impact on ordinary Russians, will undoubtedly have harms for particularly for those who can perhaps least afford them, or who can't either evade or cushion those blows. What are your thoughts on that question of the the term of art, collateral damage that can occur from sanctions at a time like this?
Well, first of all, to be honest, I wouldn't even call it collateral damage. I mean, if you follow the discussion closely, it's not a bug, it's a feature. There is no question, it's not inadvertent. If you look at, the Iraq sanctions that you just referred to, if you look at the sanctions on Iran, Venezuela, Syria, it's the goal to attack Afghanistan now, with the U.S. seizing the central bank assets.
Mm-hmm.
It is understood that civilians are going to be the primary victims of these sanctions. And it is understood and accepted. And I fear that we are far away from a world where we can stop such sanctions by pointing out, hey, wait a minute, guys, civilians are suffering. You know, we're very, very far away from that world. In the case of the Iran sanctions, when Obama came into office, President Obama came into office in 2009, on a platform, signature pledge of negotiating a diplomatic deal with Iran on Iran's nuclear program. Before he did that, he escalated the sanctions on Iran as part of, trying to get pressuring the Iranian government to agree to a deal that the U.S. felt that it could agree to. During that period, there was no concern, virtually no concern in Washington, D.C. about what was happening to Iranian civilians. I know, because I tried to do something about this. Together with the National Iranian American Council, we did a little campaign on, the impact of the banking sanctions, what was happening to Iranian children with hemophilia. The kids have hemophilia, they need special drugs to stop, because if you have hemophilia, your blood doesn't clot properly, you could die from a cut. There's drugs that compensate for that. Iran doesn't produce those drugs. So you have kids with hemophilia dying with Iran because of the cutoff of those drugs. Nobody cared. We couldn't get anybody to care. So that I fear is the fundamental dynamic on the what's happening in Afghanistan now with millions of civilians threatened with starvation. Pramila Jayapal, a chair of Congressional Progressive Caucus and collaborators, forced to vote in the House, asking the House of Representatives, asking for a report on the impact of the sanctions on Afghan civilians. The amendment was defeated, just asking for a report. No Republicans voted for it. 80% of House Democrats voted for it. So that's the world in which we live. What ended the winning card on the Iran sanctions was, how does this end? You're doing the sanctions. What is the point? Is the point just to sanction Iran forever? Or is the point to get a diplomatic deal? In which case, what is the end point? And the Obama administration, to its credit, did have a realistic endpoint. And the proof that they did is that they got a deal. they got a deal where they agreed that Iran could continue to have a nuclear program and enrich uranium under enhanced international inspections and a whole bunch of other arrangements. So I fear that in the short and medium run, that's how we get out of, and I say we, you know, that's how we rescue the foreign civilians. It's the only practical path I can see in the short to medium term of rescuing foreign civilians from these sanctions is to insist on a realistic endpoint to say, okay, you're doing the sanctions, but how does this end? How does this stop? What's the diplomatic deal that gets this to stop? To the credit of the Biden administration in this juncture, they're now talking with Venezuela again about a more realistic off-ramp for the crippling oil sanctions that the Trump administration imposed on Venezuela with the goal of overthrowing the Venezuelan government. That's openly acknowledged in the US press. So that's the, that's, I fear, the only realistic conversation about really doing something about the impact on Russian civilians of the sanctions is to end the war with the diplomatic agreement and then lift the sanctions. And some people in the US are saying to Secretary Blinken, tell us how this ends. What's the, you know, in order for Zelensky and Putin to reach a diplomatic deal, it's maybe not a sufficient condition, but it's clearly a necessary condition that the US has to say clearly, this is not forever. There is an endpoint where the sanctions that we've just imposed on Russia will end. And Blinken said the endpoint is Russian troops withdraw from Ukraine, and we have a diplomatic understanding that this is never going to happen again. So there's some kind of endpoint. That to me is, in obviously we haven't finished yet, but there we took a step down the road by making the U.S. government say, how do the sanctions on Russia end?
Okay. Yeah, I think that's it's a good point that you make early on, that notion, as you say, that it's not collateral, that the just as the explicit goal of the sanctions on the oligarchs is that they become annoyed and put pressure on Putin, general social unrest, economic unrest as a result of sanctions would have a destabilizing effect on Russian society and on the Russian government, that it's intended to have those disruptive effects rather than, I suppose, a clinical you see the numbers and you and you respond on that basis. It is intended to create the unrest that results in that internal pressure. I note, as you say, and maybe this might be a good place for us to wrap that notion of exit plans of getting out of this. There is some sense I've seen Zelensky, in recent days has been calling for direct talks with Putin. Talking about various things that he is willing to say up front are on the table, including the future of Crimea and Donbass and other separatist regions, including the future relationship with NATO. Clearly, we're not in the West, or in public at least, yet seeing those sorts of leaks or trailing statements on what the what the conditions or what the shape space would be that Putin is looking to move towards, or would be willing to move from war to diplomacy on. It does seem that we are seeing at least some signs of tension within Russian circles. We've seen I think it was a Bloomberg yesterday reporting that Putin's climate envoy has effectively has left Russia, has resigned his position, left Russia, effectively defected from Russia, in you might say, and of the central bank governor being unhappy with the economic impact of the war. Do you have a sense of what the kind of what that end, you know, what that landscape for looks like, or is that as you say, is it still something that we that isn't yet, at least to those of us on the outside, isn't yet fully visible?
I agree. Yes and yes. I have a sense. I think we all have a sense, and it's not fully visible. We can never really know. We'll know when they make a deal what a realistic deal was. Clearly, it seems like Ukraine agreeing never to join NATO is part of the deal. Zelensky has signaled that as part of the overall deal, he would agree to that in exchange for some, security, quote unquote, real security guarantees. Maybe that's more realistic now than it was because of what we've already seen the West was willing to do. The West was willing to do, if you forgive the phrase. Mm-hmm. Clearly there needs to be some compromise on Crimea and the eastern regions. Mm-hmm. There is a framework of the Minsk II Accord. So if they decide to make a deal, they could finesse this, right? There could be autonomy and, look at Iraqi Kurdistan, it's part of Iraq, it's all but independence. So you could finesse these things if they want. If the two sides get to a point where they want to make a deal, they could finesse that. Clearly, there's difficulty on both sides reaching a deal because Zelensky has a domestic constituency and Putin has a domestic constituency. Even if he's a dictator, he still has a domestic constituency. And it seems reasonable to expect that he's going to want to tell some story that he won somehow. So that has to happen in some way. We're not there yet. We hope that we can get there soon before more destruction and killing and escalation.
Great. Well, Bob, thank you so much for your time and for your insights. It's of course, always a pleasure to talk with you about these things, even troubling situations such as this, and helpful to see kind of a sense of how the processes among those who might have some impact, direct impact around legislators, around politicians, around the sorts how space gets made to get out of the disastrous violent situation we are currently in. So I do appreciate your time, and I appreciate your help with that.
Always good to speak with you.